This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week is Nick White, staff contributor for comic books. Nick, thank you so much for being here this week. How have comics been?
Comics have been pretty good. I haven't been reading quite as much over the last couple days, but I did just pick up my comics yesterday, and I've got a pretty big pile to go through, and then I went and picked up a few random things that, you know, impulse buys as well, and got myself a pretty interesting trade from Valiant. It's like a combination of their Zero issues that they've been doing, as well as some origin stories. It's sort of odd. Like, at the beginning of some of their number ones, they actually did, like, a brief one- or two-page introduction, which is kind of like, this is issue number one. How do I need, like, a two- or three-page, like, intro story? But I think they were doing that sort of to maybe bring people up to speed on what like the old Valiant universe was kind of about, because in some ways, as approachable as Valiant is, I think with some of the number ones, they wanted to sort of leave no stone unturned. At least that's what I think the intro stories were for. They might have been used with the trades. I'm not 100%, but got a lot of stuff to wade through. Got a couple variant covers. Pretty pumped to read Bloodshot number 5 and see where that goes. But not so much reading, much more accumulating, so I can wade through all that stuff later.
Right.
What about you? Have you actually gotten around to reading, or are you just also just putting things in boxes and closets and piles and hoping that
I actually have been able to read comic books this week. I think I got through all of my digital books this week. I'm still in the middle of the Wrenchies. I actually haven't continued reading that since we last spoke, I think, or the last episode of this podcast. So, unfortunately, I've just kind of been, you know, moseying about with my normal weeklies, which I think is pretty good. You know, I've read all my books. Finally read Sex Criminals number 11.
Okay.
I read a handful of my digitals just that I normally get. I read Wicked and Divine 13, which had art by Tula LaToy, which was fantastic. And actually, comic book related note, I did actually go see John Romita Jr. speak here in New York at Bryant Park on Wednesday, which was super interesting because I know that, I don't know, in the past, I really fell in love with John Romita Jr.'s art, and then I kind of grew to dislike it, and that doesn't really say anything about him as a person. I just, his art isn't necessarily my bag, even though I continue to read Kick-Ass. But if you read Kick-Ass the first volume compared to the third volume, you kind of saw like a degradation in art, but at least that's how I took it. But nonetheless, it was probably one of the most interesting talks from a comic book creator that I've ever been to, mostly because the majority of the, I think, like, panels that I've seen at conventions, that's what I was going for, panels at conventions, those are usually, like, newer comic book creators or people that have been in comics for maybe, like, 10 years or 15 years or something, whereas John Romita Jr. has been around since, like, what, the 80s? Like, the guy's been in comic books forever, and he's still doing it. Like, he's still putting out new comics, and I think that's a testament to him as a creator and as someone who just loves comics. And just hearing him talk, like, listening to him speak about how much he loves comic books and how much he's been creating how many comic books he's created, it was amazing. What I'm trying to say is John Romita Jr. really, really impressed me just as a person. The guy has... He lives and breathes comic books. At least that's what I took away. And it really just kind of grounded all of the weird build-up, like, put-up-on-a-pedestal type of things that I had about the guy, only because his name is so recognizable. Like, when you think comic books, you think John Romita Jr., and he did a lot of talking about his dad. That's the thing. He talked a lot about his dad because, quite honestly, like, his dad has been as influential in comic books as he has.
And Probably it's more.
Astounding.
I would say more.
Definitely more. But it's amazing to see, like, this legacy of comic book creation. You know, like, there, I can't think of anybody else that's out there that has this type of legacy outside of maybe Paulo Rivera, you know,
and his dad, the Kuberts.
And it's funny, he named a couple of people that he really idolizes, and it was all old school hardcore people like Jim Lee and Howard Chaykin and Andy Kubert and Adam Kubert.
Ever.
It's cool that, I don't know, I saw a different side of comic books on Wednesday, is what it comes down to. Like, there is, There are two different realms of comic books, I think, and there's like the old school 70s, 80s, 90s feel, or even, you know, that like romanticized the 50s and 60s. Right. And then there's like the now comic books where we're like, well, we've moved on from that and we're doing things a bit differently. And there's nothing wrong with either of those, but John Romita Jr. has lived in both worlds.
I was about to say, yeah, he kind of bridges the gap.
To hear him speak about it. Yeah, it is really impressive. It's really amazing. It was definitely worth taking the long lunch to go see that. So that's what I did this week, on top of reading comic books and thinking about comic books and stuff. But that was probably the highlight of my week, hands down.
Do you now feel inspired to go pick up his work on Superman, or did it not?
Funny enough,
did it not move your wallet as much as your mind?
Well, I think, I don't know. I didn't know anything about his run other than he was doing it with Jeff Johns
originally.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, and now he's doing it with Gene Yang, I think is his name.
Correct.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so together the way that he spoke about Superman. I mean, he's been in Marvel. You know, John Romita Jr. has been in Marvel for years, and like that's where he's been forever, as far as I'm concerned. And to see him move over and do Superman, the way he talked about it. He spoke like he said he'd never had any real interest in doing Superman, but when they approached him, DC basically said, hey, man, we want you to come in and work on this book, but we want you to help out as much as you can in terms of like the creation, like the creative process, like writing it and not just doing the art, but also working collaboratively with Geoff Johns to do something. So to me, I was like, okay, that's one, that's super cool. That's like a cool for DC to give him this opportunity. But two, it harkens back to, I guess I should say, it's kind of foreshadowing to what we're going to be talking about later in the episode today.
Right.
But it was kind of beautiful to hear him talk and just say, you know, I wanted to do this weird thing with Superman, or I had this idea for Silver Surfer and Marvel wouldn't do it, so I figured I'd try it at DC in a different way. And it's I don't know, it opened my eyes to it reminded me that comic books aren't so black and white as Marvel and DC, and like stories are interchangeable, and it all depends on if a publishing company or an editor is going to give the creator the opportunity to do what they want. And I don't know. It was really cool. But yeah, I to answer your question, Nick, I might try Superman, maybe. But I, like I said, I'm not a huge fan of Romita's art. But who knows? Maybe I'll learn to love it again.
Yeah. So. Okay. Maybe when the trade rolls around or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, there's no sense in not trying it at least. But anyways, let's talk about our comic picks for this week. How about that? So, Nick, what was your comic pick for this week?
I was really torn. For a while there, it was sort of Descender 6 and Batman 43, just because Descender 6 put itself in a pretty cliffhangery position, and I like that, because that book has been much more of a slow burn up until this point. But Batman 43 got the nod. I'm really interested to see where this villain of Mr. Bloom, I think it's Mr. Bloom, who looks quite a bit like Slenderman, interested to see where that goes. But on the flip side, and I think what's much more interesting, and this is really Scott Snyder guiding and taking Batman to different places other than, oh man, you know, here's a new guy for the Rogues Gallery and he's going to be really awesome. And that's really what Batman's about. Because I think in some ways, no offense, David Finch, if you're one of our few listeners, you know, I think when David Finch was on The Dark Knight, I think really that was his name of the game was that... to make a good Batman comic, you just add new people to the Rogues Gallery. In the same way that Tony S. Daniel was like, oh, here's God, I don't think I'm going to get this right. I think it was Doll Man. He added Doll Man who cut off Joker's face. I'm sure you remember that. Anyway, long story short, that's not how Scott Snyder plays the game. And I think that what's so interesting about the Batman comic is, yeah, he's introducing new villains, et cetera, but... and this is like mild spoilers. If you haven't read Batman for like the last maybe 3 months, this would be a good time to sort of skip this part.
Use your skip button.
Yeah, use your skip button or be like, well, fuck.
Don't skip the podcast.
It's so much easier for me to just hit stop and not listen to any of the rest of it. And you know, you make a good point. And so if you're thinking in terms of ease and in terms of protecting your knowledge of Batman, just hit stop. That's fine.
Please don't stop listening to this podcast.
For those still listening, obviously it's been revealed, yes, Jim Gordon is Batman. Yes, Bruce Wayne, still alive. Unless Scott Snyder's playing some weird clone, doppelganger, twin, whatever other bullshit tropes exist. Unless he's playing one of those cards, Bruce Wayne is indeed alive and well, mm-hmm. and isn't really that interested at resuming the mantle. So we actually have a scene, I think in 42, where Jim Gordon talks to Bruce, sort of just about, if I remember right, and maybe this was part of the preview for 43, but just about the legacy of Batman or sort of taking on the role. And it's, to my understanding, it's a little dubious whether or not, I mean, obviously I think Bruce knows that Gordon is Batman now. Does Gordon know that Bruce was actually Batman? Who knows? But it's fascinating to see Bruce in a position where...
No, this sounds incredibly complex, Nick.
No. It's this simple. Jim's Batman now. Bruce used to be Batman. Bruce knows that Jim is Batman, pretty certain. Jim does not know that Bruce was ever Batman, although, of course, I think that's intimated. Bottom line is this. It's really interesting to see Bruce... not so eager to resume the mantle. He's just working at like a sort of a volunteer center of sorts. And there was a really long, really interesting interview with Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. I think it was on Comics Alliance where they sort of discussed this idea that Bruce doesn't appear to be resuming any capacity of being Batman, which is interesting because it's not to say that Bruce hasn't relinquished or given up or surrendered the cape and cowl in the past, but he's always sort of gone back to some aspect of being Batman. And Scott Snyder was touching on the idea that, like, when Batman died at the end of Endgame, quote-unquote died, only then was Bruce Wayne truly allowed to live again. You know what I mean?
And right.
I think that's so fascinating that it's sort of a rebirth for him. And I read that Scott Snyder said that he feels like this is finally the time to actually introduce after 4 years to sort of do some sort of a love interest thing now that, you know, he's not totally Batman. And so it can't just be some sort of throwaway girlfriend who ends up A, turning out to be the bad guy, B, turning out to just get fridged, et cetera, et cetera. So it's super interesting. I mean, we've got a new Batman in a new suit and it's Gordon, and that's super interesting. But oddly enough, for me, and I suspect for a lot of other Batman readers, that's not the most fascinating thing. It's the fact that we've got Bruce Wayne being quote-unquote a normal guy, and Scott Snyder gets to tell that story, a story that I suspect most other top-selling big two books, their editor would hang up the phone or laugh in their face. So,
well, especially given DC's record in the past with characters being normal and having normal lives that are semi-happy, this definitely seems out of the ordinary. Like, that's the red flag that I see from the outside of things.
Right.
Well, that sounds like an interesting issue. It sounds like this could be... I mean, this is what the question that's constantly on my mind is, when is Scott Snyder going to be done with this book? Is he going to be done with this book, you know?
Right.
So, could this be like the beginning of the end, or is maybe he ramping up for another 43 issues here?
You know, that's a very good question, and they also asked Scott Snyder about that, and I know he gave a more concrete answer than the one I'm about to give you, but I believe he said that he normally has Batman, just on a very rough level, Batman is plotted out a full year in advance. Like, he knows on a, like I said, it's not like concrete scripts, you know what I mean? But on a very vague, rough level, he knows where Batman's going for the next year.
Right,
and, right. And, yeah, I mean, I think Capullo said his contract is up for renewal next year.
Okay.
So we'll see. I mean, I think it would be super interesting to have a brand new team on this book, although I think the flip would be more interesting. I'd love to see them on other books. And as much as I absolutely love Capullo, I think it would also be very interesting to see Scott Snyder with a different artist on the book. I mean, bottom line, I love both of them, and wherever both of them go, I'll pretty much follow it regardless. So, unless they end up making me, you know, read something like don't move either of them on to like Teen Titans or something, because I won't I won't read that.
But Nick, that's the challenge. You say how much do you love these creators? That's the thing.
That's really it, and not that much apparently. So. what about you? What's your pick?
Well, my pick for this week is Constantine Hellblazer number 3.
Ooh.
Because I love this book to death, and I will read it until it... You know, I said this about the original, the other Constantine series that they launched when New 52 came out, or back near the end of the New 52, whatever you want to call that, during the New 52, I guess we could say.
The Ray Fox and, one.
Yeah, the Ray Fox book, and I was really interested. I really wanted to read Hellblazer. I really wanted to read a book with Constantine in it that was a solo book, and that just seemed really cool to me.
Sure.
And it kind of let me down, but which we've talked about before. But this book, two issues in, I am, like, salivating for more of this book. It is so fun. Like, it feels like a book that should have been released a couple years ago because it's not tied to anything. And I don't know much about the creators. I mean, I know about Riley Rossimo, and I think in this issue, I think, isn't done by Riley Rossimo. It's done by Vanessa Del Rey.
Yep.
It's written by James Tinian and Ming Doyle. And really, I mean, this is like my one toe in the pool of DC at this point. I'm kind of reading Martian Manhunter. I mean, I should say I am reading Martian Manhunter, and I keep trying Black Canary. But okay. This is the book that I think is very solidified for me. I'm going to keep reading it. I'm going to try to push through the bad stuff, if there is even bad stuff. At this rate, I can't even see how they could mess this book up. It's so much fun. It feels like its own independent thing, and it feels like that idea that we talked about, that you had spoke about, Nick, when DC was doing this post-New 52 thing where they, or maybe Paul was talking about it, where continuity isn't so important so much as we tell a good story, and I'm really hoping that this is the book. And there's so much going on that went on in the first two issues that sold and made everything right for what I wanted out of this book that I just want to keep reading it. With the ghosts and how do you kill a ghost and how do you, like, who are these demon people, and John Constantine just kind of knows everyone and like has connections. It feels like what I imagine Constantine to be, or the Hellblazer to be. Having not really read much, this idea in my head of what Constantine is and who he is as a character feels fully fleshed out in this book. And I wish Riley Rossimo was on this book still, but I am totally fine with him going back to Rasputin and doing Rasputin. I'd rather have him do that than Constantine. In a magical world, he'd be able to do both.
Priorities, yeah.
Yeah, priorities, you know. But this book, so far, has sold me, and at the end of issue three, or at the end of issue two, he was heading back to London, so this is the first issue in London. And to me, Constantine going back to London means, like, the most awful shit in the entire world is going to happen to him. So I'm really excited, because John Constantine is one of those characters you love to see in a bad place at the wrong time. So I'm real excited for this week. It should be really good.
Yeah. I'm excited to see where Vanessa Del Rey takes the art. I mean, I saw some preview stuff. Her work on Hit was great. Honestly, it's not like they're bringing in someone who doesn't know what they're doing. And I think her art strikes that sweet spot of, well, I mean, let me just put it this way. I'm okay with a totally different artist on the book as long as they're still competent.
Right.
Sort of a different style, but I think you have to create some sort of a compromise, and I think Vanessa Del Rey is that perfect compromise of looking somewhat like Rossimo's art. It's stylized, it's a little loose, it's a little bit, you know, whatnot, but it also is its own style, because there's nothing more I dislike more than when they just bring someone in who's very close, but just not as, quote-unquote, not as good as the person they're supposed to be imitating. So,
or a complete left turn too. Sometimes when they just throw a new artist that isn't remotely close and it's not even that great of art, it's super problematic, I think.
Yeah, different art is totally okay, but tonally what Riley Rossimo set for this book of just being sort of light and colorful and energetic. Without being bubbly, you know, it's oddly like Batman right now. It's oddly very colorful and bright and flashy, but it still also finds a way to be dark. And I like that. And I absolutely love that, like, Tinian is wasting no time in sort of taking the little shreds that they acknowledge from the New 52 Constantine and just kind of throwing some of them in the trash. So the fact that he's like, issue three, we're going back to London, none of this New York stuff anymore, we're going back to where it all began, and they're like, boom, issue three, we're returning. I was like, okay, that's good.
This book is
slowly removing those little remnants.
Yeah, It's so much fun. I don't know. I haven't had this much fun in a new or in a big two book in a long time. I think it's been like since the introduction or the beginnings of say Hawkeye or maybe even Miss Marvel have I not had this much fun. So this is, and again, you know, I'm gonna just keep wearing this hat of I don't read DC books, but it's really true. I don't read DC books very often, so this is kind of refreshing to see. I dove into this book and I'm really enjoying it. I don't feel like I need to know all this information. You know, that constant complaint that we have about big two books. Right. It's just kind of like running with this character, and it's so much fun. Like this book is killer. So we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna scream about Black Widow for a moment, and then we'll talk about some other stuff. So we'll be back in just a quick second.
You have plenty of company. As you'll soon see.
Well, for those of you checking the time, I'll let you know that it's time for Marvel Ignores Female Protagonist O'Clock. That's right. It's that moment every couple months when Marvel decides that despite their success with their movies and their merchandise, et cetera, so on and whatnot, that they are going to continue to chronically underrepresent their female protagonists. Now, it's not to say that DC doesn't have this problem in their comics, but it's also to say that DC really hasn't moved on to the film stage, so we really can't criticize them on that level. That being said, we've had issues with Black Widow in the past. If you remember, there was that motorcycle toy that came out of the Age of Ultron merchandise where it was, it was that cycle thingy that drops down from the helicarrier, I think, and I'm probably getting all these terms wrong. It's that jet they have. It's not...
You're right. Anyway. No, you're right.
Okay. So it drops down...
It's a Quinjet or something. It's a Quinjet.
No, I believe, I don't know. No. God damn it. It's their jet. It's their personal jet, and you've seen the movie, so you're like, I understand, Nick. I've seen the movie. You don't need to come up with a name. I'm not struggling about what you're talking about either. Just get on with it. That being said, if you saw the movie, of course, it's Black Widow that rolls down the gangplank or whatever and drives off. And, of course, they put Captain America on the bike because that's what happened in the movie. Oh, wait, it's not what happened in the movie. They did it because they're selling toys to boys.
Well, I mean, he did technically ride the motorcycle at the beginning of the movie, but that was not the iconic scene.
Bingo. Exactly.
I'll say that.
That's good. Let's deal with those one or two fanboys that are going to have problems. So now that they're dealt with, of course, people got mad, et cetera, et cetera. This was not the first time. People had done studies of all the merchandise coming out for Age of Ultron and some of the other movies, and I think they were saying that like Black Widow roughly showed up on, and I could be wrong, but I think it was probably somewhere between 2 and 8%. And even if it's 8%, even if it's 10%, that's still really, really awful. So it started a hashtag, I believe it was hashtag Where's Widow. People got pretty upset, a lot of high-profile people, including Mark Ruffalo, who apparently has no problem shitting where he eats, got in on it. And said that he was mad about it. All joking aside, kudos to him. That's, you know, maybe not the smartest, but I'm proud of him for doing that. And of course, a lot of us said, wow, Marvel, this is kind of insensitive. Maybe this isn't totally like you. I hope you don't do this again. It got on BuzzFeed. It got on all of the other websites where people go that I try to stay away from. And it was a thing for a bit back in May. And people said, oh man, I hope Marvel doesn't do this again. That would be kind of bad. Oh wait, it happened again. On the front cover of the Age of Ultron DVD and the Age of Ultron Blu-ray, because they're going to go for 2 for 2, why not at least be consistent in your prejudice, Black Widow is nowhere to be found. Well, you can say, well, Nick, what about Scarlet Witch? Is she there? Is at least there some sort of gender representation, diversity? Nope, she's not there either. So that happened. People are obviously a little bit miffed.
No, this is for just the UK cover, right? The UK cover for the Blu-ray and the DVD.
I mean, I think my example was, but I honestly have to believe that I don't think the cover is going to be different. I mean, yeah, maybe right. I'm totally wrong.
Nonetheless,
it still happened in some capacity.
Yeah, a major portion of the buying population of these of Avengers: Age of Ultron. The covers for these DVD and Blu-ray only features Captain America, Iron Man, Hulk, and Thor. and Ultron in the case of the Blu-ray.
Yep.
No Scarlet Witch, no Hawkeye, no Black Widow, and more importantly, no Black Widow, a key member, and Hawkeye too. Everyone shits on Hawkeye. I shouldn't shit on Ultron either.
Yeah.
No Ultron on the DVD, but still, no Black Widow, no Hawkeye, and these are key members of the Avengers, and these are people, these are characters that people look up to and love, and yet they get no representation because why? I think, Nick, in the pre-show, you had said something along the lines of, well, these are the characters that have franchises around them. And it's like, well, that implies another systemic problem, right?
Yeah.
Why doesn't Black Widow have her own movie in the first place? And she was crucial in Captain America. Like, that movie could not have worked without her. She was crucial in Avengers. She was crucial in Age of Ultron. Why isn't she as equally represented as her male counterparts? No one seems to know why. And that's absolute bullshit is what it comes down to, especially because in my mind, sorry, Nick, I'm just taking your soapbox. I pushed you off. Now I'm up on it. The DVD cover for Avengers is the exact same poster that they use to promote Avengers Age of Ultron, which has Black Widow and has Hawkeye, has Vision in the background, has Nick Fury. All of the characters are there, but for some reason, to fit on the DVD, they decided to just shop them out. Like, what the hell is going on here? That's what I have to keep asking.
Mama said shop you out.
Yes.
And, you know, there is some sort of twisted marketing logic to be had here. Anyone could say, well, we went with the covers, the characters that are most iconic. We went with the characters that have their own film franchises, which is true. You got Iron Man, you got Hulk, even though there hasn't been a Hulk movie in a while. You've got Thor, and you've got Cap. And on some level, I understand that. They want to go with more recognizable characters. They want to go with those that already have pre-established franchises, because I'm sure subconsciously it means that there's intermingling marketing. But that doesn't mean that it's not a very future-forward-looking way of approaching things. And of course, beyond that, as I told you in the pre-show notes, that sort of weird, apologetic argument it still does not go over well with me. In the end, it boils down to Marvel, how do you think this looks to people? How do you think people view this? How do you think, especially those of us that have noted and remember all of these other interesting little incidents over the past year, look at this and say, okay, maybe Marvel isn't incapable of learning their lesson, or maybe they think, well, don't read into things, that's not, you know, well, sorry, we're talking about comic books. Reading into things is like the number one thing we know how to do, or the only thing we've found ourselves doing. So yeah, just it doesn't look good, and here we are having this discussion again.
But to your point, though, about this, well, here are the most iconic characters. You do realize, I mean, and this is me speaking to Marvel, I guess, or whatever. You do realize that by putting a character on a cover makes them iconic.
Mm-hmm.
So by not putting them on, you're kind of just like feeding into the cycle when you could easily just inject a character. Like, you have all of the power to potentially put someone on this cover. And the fact that you didn't means that these are the characters you think are important because this is what your brand is. Your brand is four dudes on a cover.
You're limiting yourself to these characters that have already been proven that they can make money.
Right.
Why not? Like
you could take all four of those characters off and put Black Widow, Hawkeye, and Nick Fury on the cover with Ultron, and people go, holy shit, that's Avengers. Like, you don't need these faces to necessarily promote that. And the fact that you aren't using these other figures, like a person of color or a woman, on this just goes to show that this is the direction you think that you're going. I mean, this is Disney, I guess, or this is Marvel, and I don't know. It's a huge problem. It's a huge problem.
For Avengers 1...
We had to scream about it today.
Yeah. For Avengers 1, maybe this would have made sense, where it's like, hey, remember these guys? They've got movies, and they're all going to be in this movie. And then someone's like, oh, man, I didn't know that. I really appreciate you filling me in on this.
Yeah.
But, like, fuck, that was like 4 years ago or whatever. Like,
that was... And this is the sequel.
Yeah.
With established characters. Like, if you're someone that's just going out and buying Age of Ultron without having seen or heard of any of these other movies, man, like,
please write us a fan letter.
Yeah, where have you been living under a rock, man? I don't know. We're a little bit invested, obviously, so maybe we're incredibly biased.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, like, recognition, but come on. That's all I gotta say. Just come on. Here we go. Hey, here we go. Hey. Nick, let me ask you a question about comic book collection. Just out of the blue, for no specific reason.
Right.
Do you think this isn't a prompt? This isn't a prompt at all.
Yeah.
Do you think that with all the comics that you've collected over your entire, you know, comic book reading career, that's something that I really like saying.
Yeah.
Do you think that those comics are going to make you rich? Like, one day you're going to be able to sit down, you're going to say, yeah, look at all these comics. I'm going to sell them all and I'm going to be rich. Do you think that that's a thing in your life, I guess?
Yeah, I'm totally. I mean, that's kind of the plan right now. Is I look at each comic and I say to myself, Nick, let's just level with yourself. So I just go through and I double the value of each comic. I double what I paid for them, and roughly that's what I plan on getting back. I mean, I feel like that's reasonable. Like double. Like, some people are like, Nick, you shoot for the stars. Maybe this will be worth $1 million. And I'm like, shut up. I live in the real world. I think I'm only going to get $12 for Green Lantern Corps number 7. You're so stupid. No.
But no, right.
Exactly. Right. No. It's like, I mean, I have, like, Star Wars toys from when I grew up, and I still think maybe some of those are going to be worth something at some point. And
but
I think
are they
that's
still
probably,
in the box? Are they still in the box?
Fuck. I was a normal kid. I mean, as normal as any, like, Star Wars obsessed kid. I once traded away my Anakin lightsaber card. I cried for days. Like, I sold it for Han's blaster pistol. And I was like, this card is so badass. But then I was like, I really don't have a good Han Solo card to use this. And so
I have no idea what you're talking about in terms of cards, Nick.
I'm talking about Star Wars CCG, Star Wars Collectible Card Game, started by Decipher Entertainment in 1994.
Okay.
So you can look that up later. But I collected Star Wars cards, and I collected Lord of the Rings cards as well. And yeah, of course, at some point you're like, oh man, this is going to be worth money. And truth be told, unless you live in a big enough city where there's like super specialized people that want to buy it, or you sell it at the right point, none of this stuff is going to be worth money. So long story short, I've come in with the expectation that, and I think this is maybe not the most healthy one, but it's the most grounded one, I would not be shocked or surprised if in 10, 15, 20 years, I turned around and wasn't getting anything for my comics. Anything.
Right.
And I think that's the approach one has to have.
Right.
Honestly.
So, yeah, obviously the reason I bring this up is, Nick, you threw an article my way, I want to say a couple days ago for this week's podcast, that was a USA Today story called Comic Book Investing Can Be Smart Money.
It's POW! Exclamation point. Comic book investing can be smart money.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
So the funniest thing about this article is when I saw this, I literally thought, had I not seen the date, I really just saw the title initially. I thought this is certainly an article published in like 1994, brought back from the archives to say, hey guys, can you believe how fucking ridiculous we were? And it turns out it was published on August 4th, 2015, and it was all about how someone had recently sold the new Superman Action Comics number 12, wasn't it? Action Comics number one. Okay, never mind. Sorry. I'm thinking Amazing Fantasy. That's a whole different thing with Spider-Man. So they had sold Action Comics number one for $3.2 million. And this article was all about how, you know, you have to chase characters. You have to realize what's coming out, what's going to be popular, what are the books that people are going to want to buy because, you know, they're becoming popular again, or those characters are becoming popular. And it's astounding to think that people are still doing this, that they're chasing this. And as someone who's been, you know, let me put my hat on and say, I've been reading comic books for about 10 years now. I have never once thought, man, I should buy this comic book, or maybe I should find this old copy of this comic book so that I can try to turn it around and resell it. Never once have I thought that comic books were going to be a money thing. And I you know, in reading comic books and studying, quote unquote, studying history, the history of comic books, I realized that this was like the downfall of comics. And there's a really cool, or back in the 90s, this was almost the downfall of comics. Nick linked me to a really cool YouTube video that goes over pretty much my exact thoughts on the matter, which I'll link in the show notes. But at the end of the day, comic books are not a viable like option for making money. I mean, I'm just going to destroy the quote that you posted in here, Nick, which is, comic books are turning into a viable option for people looking to invest in something more tangible. It's totally not the truth. it just blows my mind that things like this are still being published, because if whoever wrote this article really must not be in comic books, that's really, I don't ever mean to say that like that, but they must not be reading comic books regularly or in the business of selling in comic books, because at the end of the, I keep saying at the end of the day, a lot of this
could be the middle of the day,
could be the middle of the morning,
whatever time.
It's, whenever you're listening to this,
we are not time centric individuals. we realize we're open minded people.
Yeah.
At whatever point of the day, go on.
Yeah.
Mike.
At whatever point of the day, comic books. If you're looking to try to find a comic book to try to resell to somebody or resell to a comic shop, chances are you're not going to find it unless you're buying like from an estate sale of someone who had a bunch of comics, because most of the time comic book shops, if they have these like key issues, is what usually is the phrase, issues of Guardians of the Galaxy or of Iron Man or of Superman or Batman or something. I mean, in the bigger the name, the harder the comics are going to be to find. 9 times out of 10, they have these comics already and they're up behind the shelf in like a Mylar bag or in like pressed in some plastic, or they've been laminated in some way to preserve them. And they're selling them for an outrageous amount of money. And it's not outrageous, because the reason why they're priced that way is because of the quality of the book and the rarity of the book. But they have these books already. They're selling them, and they probably bought them from someone cheaper than what they're selling them for. It's just like a pawn shop in that way, where they have to be able to make money off of it. So they're only going to buy a book that's worth, quote-unquote, worth $600 from you for like $400, because they need to turn a profit on the object. And they also need to be able to determine if it's going to be sellable at that price. So they can only buy it from you for a certain amount of money, because having it on their shelf is technically costing them money. It may be pennies on the dollar, but nonetheless, if it's up there for 5 years and no one buys it, then what was the point of them buying it from you in the first place? So,
right,
it's a bizarre that people are still thinking this way. Like, I watched that Kevin Smith show, Nick, that you told me about.
Comic Book Men.
Yeah, Comic Book Men. And I giggled at all these people trying to come in to try to make a buck, like a quick buck, a lot of money really quickly off of these comics or these action figures or whatever that they have. And I just don't think we're in that market anymore. Like, yeah, you could be the one person out of 10,000 that has this happen to them, but that does not make it the rule.
Right.
Soapbox done. Go ahead, Nick. Respond to me.
Yeah. No. I think the whole article is really based on. I mean, I think I know how this article was written. Being a writer myself. Just kidding. Just really being someone who has some sort of basic logical understanding of how pitches and how leads work. I think this guy saw the news article about Action Comics number 1 and said, this is a news piece that I'm going to convert into sort of a advice piece or something like that. So he saw the headline and said, I can flip this into something else. And sure, Action Comics, it's monumental that someone has one in that grade. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. That's newsworthy. They actually managed to flip it and sell it to someone and made some major money. Yeah, that's absolutely newsworthy too. I'm not going to get all mad about that. But the idea that this one exception is going to make the rule that, oh, okay, guys, he sold Action Comics number 1. Good news. We're back into the heyday of expensive comics going for lots of money. It's official. No, this is an exception that does not prove the rule. And you're absolutely right. The guy talks about focusing on finding older comics. Well, I have news for you, and you're totally right. Unless, and I don't want to retread too much on it, but yeah, unless you're hanging around an estate sale or something like that, where you've got people who not only A, collected comics, B, kept them in decent condition, and C, despite those two things, didn't know what was worth shit, ended up unloading them in whatever capacity, you know, unless you're surrounding yourselves with some real dum-dums, you're not going to get your hands on anything of value. It's just true. I mean, if you think you're going to go into your
just
fucking comic books...
Just talking down to everybody.
Yeah. I mean, unless you're hanging out with people, like I said, who paradoxically, A, kept their comics in good condition, or maybe they were related to someone, if it's the you know, an estate sale, you know, oh, you know, my relative kept his comics in great condition. Maybe we won't even bother to see if any of them have any value. So here you go for a dime. You know, unless you're in a scenario like like that, you're not going to get your hands on any of the quote-unquote good stuff anyway. You're not going to go into your comic book store and leaf through their pull boxes and go, ha ha ha, you guys are so stupid. Here's Amazing Spider-Man number whatever.
It's a key issue. It's the first appearance of the Punisher, you know?
Right, like, exactly. That stuff is on the wall, behind the counter, in glass, or in a locked, you know, whatever. So, yeah, it's... And he goes on to talk about how, you want to focus on older comics, you want to focus on the first appearances of characters or villains or whatever, and sure, these things are kind of no-brainers, I guess, if you were generally looking... maybe not so much to find an issue worth money. Maybe you're just trying to buy an issue that you think is worth some money, which I still don't think that's a wise idea. But if that's what you're trying to do, yes, he's right. First appearances of anything are important, blah-de-blah-de-blah, sure.
For collection. Like, if you want to collect these books, I mean, that's all the power to you. Yeah. Like, the reason why we buy these comics and keep them is to collect them. There's nothing wrong with that. I just want to make that clear.
And I think even before you go down that road, I think really it just really boils down to if you're in this because you're trying to make money or you're trying to buy comics that are worth money or you're trying to keep comics that you think are worth money and that's your entire contribution to comics, there's something just... If this is strictly investment, go find something else. There are better things. There are much more stable or possibly, you know, whatever. There are much better venues to try to turn a buck in.
Absolutely.
But that being said, if you were trying to actually get your hands on comics that you think aren't worth much now that are going to be possibly worth something later, I think you have to look at The Walking Dead and say, okay, it's not big two books. It's like Image books that are being adapted like onto like a cable series, like maybe like The Strain, for example. You know, The Strain would be another example. Something that's being adapted onto a more mature or edgy network, and it's reaching, you know, broad, you know, acclaim on that level. So again, I hope you're not doing it just for collecting, but if you are, I would say that's how you would turn a buck anyway. So I think he's not even right in his approach of what's
get on the old market. Books. I think the point you may have been, I think you said to me in the pre-show, was that buying Image number ones is like the thing to do. If you wanted to actually try to mass market your way into trying to find valuable books, you would do, as Nick said to me earlier, you would buy every single Image number one regardless. No matter who's writing it, no matter what it's about, you would just buy them all. You would go to a comic shop and you'd buy their old all their old issues of number ones and stuff like that from the past 5 years. You would find, if you were able to find all those number ones, you would have Sex Criminals number one, which is being adapted. You would have
Descender,
which just is being got adapted. Optioned. All these books, like Peter Panzerfaust for a while, I had Peter Panzerfaust 1-12, which at one point was quoted, the collection together was quoted at like $650 because that series was going to be adapted on the BBC, and then that fell through, and then the price of those comics drastically declined, and I didn't know that when I went to go try to sell them before I moved here.
No.
So things like that. So it's keeping up with news, seeing what's going to be optioned, keeping up with creators to see where they're going with things. If they're on the rise, potentially buying their old indie books is a thing that you could do, or just, I don't know, at the end of the day, trying to make money off of comics isn't a thing as much. I mean, like, you may get lucky and have a copy of a number one, but like, I have a copy of Saga number one, which I think I could probably sell for like $90 if it's in pretty good condition. I don't want to do that because I collect these books. Like, I want to have those for myself so that I could A, go back and read them, or B, just to say that I have them. I don't know. It's like a bragging right. That the value there is bragging rights in a way, you know?
Right.
But that was an easy buy for me. That was something that said, hey, it's Brian K. Vaughan. His stuff always does well, so I'm going to buy that. Whereas Peter Panzerfaust, like, I took a total risk on that book because I like Peter Pan. I thought it was a cool book. And then it potentially had all this great success. And I was like, wow, what a lucky find for me. But I just bought the book because I liked it, you know? So... I don't know. There's no money making in it for me, so I don't understand why there's no money making in it for other people. So you're all stupid, and I'm not. Goodbye.
No.
I don't actually think that's what it is. I truly, objectively think that there isn't a lot of money in comics like that. Making comic books, maybe running a shop, maybe, but not like buying and reselling. But I don't know. I could keep rambling on. So
it's, yeah, I mean, if you're in this industry strictly because you are interested in making money, putting aside sort of my moral and ethical issues about, well, comic books are meant to be read, or the argument that maybe you are indirectly contributing to some other great fallout that we're going to have in comic books, all of that aside, and simply saying, hi, I want to get into comics because I think this is a place to make some money, I'm just going to flat out say, nope.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. Produced by Mike Rappin, and produced and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Narosh, Spag Hetty, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep up with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you'd like us to talk about something on the podcast, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. Also, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter @destroythecyb and follow us on Tumblr @destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And as always, thank you for listening.
That's a, we are all negativity this week. It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was toying with the idea with Xander. I said, you know, some weeks we get really negative, and maybe this was like I was looking into the future in my dreams.
Yeah.
And I said, like, you know, we should try to round out our episodes with like something positive. Like, what was good about comic books for you this week? I think we had like tried that at some point earlier on and it just didn't work.
Yeah.
But like episodes like this where I'm just got like, I'm nothing but like venom and anger.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I don't know. I think, like, what have you been reading? What are you interested in? What's your pick of the week? I think those segments were all very positive and very interesting.
Okay, and I agree with like, that. Yeah, yeah.
I realize I'm now trying to subsequently go down the list and justify every segment. and with this, we're trying to save our industry, and we're trying to save these people money. That's really it. I don't want these people, flooding the market. I don't want them thinking they're gonna make money. Because in the end, maybe on a totally selfish reason, these people thinking they're gonna make money, they're sometimes the ones that are denying. Like, I might want the same issue that they want. Now,
right.
Well, they just want to put it in plastic and put it in a box. I actually want to read the damn thing, enjoy it, talk about it, discuss it, and then yes, eventually I'll put it in a plastic and put it in a box too.
Xander, if you could somehow make this work, I'm going to go off on a thing right here. So I go to Midtown every week, right? Midtown, one of the biggest comic book shops in New York City. In the country, I think. If not the country, right?
Yeah.
It is a fantastic shop in the sense that they get so many comic books. They get all the variants. They get all the cool shit. They get all the stuff that all the little shops all over the U.S. really want but can never afford. Like, we always talk about this 1 in 25 variant, this 1 in 100 variant. These guys get those books because they know they have customers for it, right?
They've got those books.
Yeah, and those books go back behind the shelf a lot of the time. Like, Valiant, or what was it, Book of Death cover that you were talking to me about, Nick, that I said was $60. They had two copies of it, just because.
The Paolo Rivera incentive cover, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what the incentive was, but they had it. Like, they had that 1 in 10 one, too, and I got you a copy of that. But that was on the regular shelf. I didn't have to ask for it. Whereas, like, the one in the $60 variant, the $125 variants, like, those are behind the thing. But what I'm trying to get to is every week on Wednesday, I walk in, and whether I go at lunch or if I go at lunch, it's a little less so than if I go at 5 or 6 when I get out of work. But there are guys there that will take a whole stack of books. They will grab a stack of 30 or 40 of them, put them in their hands, and just leaf through all of them to try to find the one that has the least amount of damage, and then they'll pick it out. And they'll pick these books up and grab them. Like, have you ever carried 30 floppy, unbagged, and boarded books before? Like, you're not doing the book service by doing that. There was a guy who walked through and he grabbed, so there was the one with Robert California, whose name escapes me.
The Blacklist.
Yeah, the Blacklist. Thank
Blacklist.
You.
Just Black. I think just.
Yeah, Blacklist.
Regardless.
That
James
comic
what's
book came
his face?
Out.
James Spader. Yeah.
James Spader, Ultron. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows and loves him.
he don't have any strings on me or whatever. Let's butcher that quote while we're at it. Go ahead.
So they did this cover for that book, which had his face. I think for the whole series, I think it's like a 6-issue mini or something. They did all the main characters on covers, and it was a photo. And then they did another like comic book cover, like a drawn cover. And so Midtown had a bunch of copies of both, because I think it was like a 1-in-1 variant kind of thing where they were splitting it 50-50 based on distribution.
Where it's not really a value. Yeah.
It's not a value variant, but it's like, hey, if you have a personal preference, here's your cover. Like, I do that every week for like Injection. They have two covers. Yeah. I always pick the one that I like.
I don't mean to knock it. I like it. Yeah.
I totally agree with that. I think it's like, get your preferred cover. It's super cool. Which is one of the reasons I like Avatar. But back to the point, this guy, going through the Blacklist covers, he was picking out every single cover that had what's his name on it? Like every
Spader.
Had Spader's face on. He picked out all of them. It was probably like 25. And he walked up to the counter and he fucking bought them. He got in line before me. I don't know if they let him buy all of them, but he bought every single one of them as far as I know. I could not believe that was like allowed, but at the end of the day, it's kind of like commerce versus like request thing, where like if you had all those copies and someone wanted to buy it, there's no real rule that says you can't buy it outside of the store's policy, and I don't know what their policy is on that. I'm not someone that's going to even push that line, because I don't need 25 copies of Blacklist number one at my house, you know? But this guy went and he bought all of them, and in my head I'm like, what's he going to do? Is he going to go down to the street and try to sell them for $10 a pop? Is he going to sell them on eBay? It kind of just like rubbed me the wrong way, and I was like,
maybe he's going to cut out James Spader's face on all of them and make some really fucked up collage or something.
I couldn't believe that happened. And
if
we
you're listening
about
and
this,
that's what you're doing, that's cool. That's cool.
It's like I listened to the Volta Midnight podcast, and those guys have said multiple times that they don't allow people to do that. If they watch someone walk in and they pick up 10 issues out of the 25 issues that they have of a number one, they're like, hey man, we're only gonna let you buy 5, you know, and we aren't gonna let you buy any more if you come back in. Like they know that these people exist, and since they're a pretty big shop in Ann Arbor, but they're not the biggest shop in the world, so they know that there are people that are coming in that are like you and me that want to buy a book to read it. We're not looking for resale value. We're not looking for, you know, to put it on our, you know, like flea market table or something like that. Whatever people do with all these extra comics that they buy, we're buying books to read them. Like maybe we'll buy 2 or 3 or 4 copies for ourselves, but like, we go out of our way to talk to our shop to work that out so that we're not dicking over anybody else. You know, like if I want a special variant, I put in the order for that variant. I don't go out of my way to like buy 10 copies of a book or something like that. Like you worked your way to get all of those extra copies of A Book of Death. Like you worked with your comic book shop. You talked to me and I bought an extra copy for you like here and there. You weren't like trying to spam your one shop and deny people comic books. You were trying to go out and get specific covers, which is what the variant covers are all about. So I just had to get that out there. I saw that, it was a couple weeks back, and I was just like, bleh. And now that we're talking about it, so
that's just super weird.
This shit exists. Like
we talk about it like
it's a myth, and it's fucking real. It's bizarre.
I was at my shop on the day that they let loose the and I think maybe we've talked about this before a little bit, but on the day that they quote unquote killed off Donatello, and the guy running my shop, like, he fielded 3 or 4 phone calls during the course of me being there, and it was just people calling trying to get their hands on that issue. And he got off the phone and he was mad, and he's like, you know what, none of these people regularly come to this shop, you know, or they're not customers. They're not people I know. They don't have a pull here. These people they've got a list of every single damn comic book shop in the area, and they're just going to find which one, and they're going to get their hands on it. And so, yeah, maybe this is what in some extent, to, you know, beat this phrase to death, maybe this is what it boils down to. But these people are sometimes wrecking our fun. Because they automatically want to seal it up, and we'd rather like to read it because that is its function. Because
we're the shitty Star Wars kid who took the action figures out of the box and played with them.
Right.
To call back to what you were saying earlier.
Yeah, exactly. I'm mad that kid grew up and he's still doing the same fucking thing. You know.